For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Welcome, everyone. Good morning. I'm Tygen Layton, teacher at the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and I'm very happy to have as our guest speaker this morning Hozan Allen Sanocki, an old friend and a very fine Dharma teacher. Allen is the vice abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center and has taught in many centers around the country and is an old colleague as a Dharma teacher and mutual consultant. Allen's talented in many ways, also a very fine long-time musician and activist, and I'll speak more about that later, but he's here this morning to give us a Dharma talk. So thank you very much for coming to Chicago.
Thank you, Tygen. I'm happy to be back here. It's been a number of years, and I always I enjoy meeting this Sangha, and actually I enjoy being in Chicago when it's neither too hot nor too cold. I thought I would talk about something that's been a challenge for me as long as I can remember. A challenge in my life, and then it's been a challenge in the context of my practice. And it's only recently that I've been writing and talking about this as an actual dimension of my practice, and it comes from hearing many people. But it's talking about how one works with, lives with, practices with moments or propensities towards depression in one's life, which is not so uncommon. And the beginning of this, of what I wrote, as I wrote an essay about this, it came at a meeting with our senior priests, actually, at Berkeley Zen Center, and somebody was doing a check-in as we do, sort of going around saying how they are, and this friend of mine was saying, "Well, I'm having a really hard time," and he used these four words that really resonated with me. It starts with dread. There was something really powerful about that. And I thought, yes, I know exactly what he's talking about. So, it starts with dread. I may be in a distant city, like here or Bangkok or somewhere, and I'm lying on the covers, on top of the covers, and strange bed, and there's a fan that's humming, kind of like that, like those, and or I might be driving alone on the interstate late in the night, you know, rolling past just dark open country with very few lights, or going by strip malls and chain stores, or just walking down a street feeling a kind of emptiness, not the good Buddhist emptiness, which is actually fullness, but just there's something really missing. So this dread has a physical quality. It feels like a real weight on my chest and on my shoulders. And sometimes it's a gnawing sensation in my stomach, and just really a wish to if anything, not be in the present moment. You know, really to jump out of that moment however I can. So within these sensations, there's loneliness, sense of separation, despair, and there's a fear that, oh, this is the way my life is going to be from now on. You know, when I'm away from home, I can be lying in this state, just lying in my room and thinking, all I want to do is be home in bed watching television, which is actually, I almost never do. that's like some imaginary idea of what would be comforting, and it's you know, I know that it's not going to. First of all, I can't be there because I'm here, and second, if I were there, lying in bed watching television would not assuage these feelings. So, but actually, if I'm traveling, sometimes one of the things I'll do is think through all the steps that it would take actually to get me home. You know, like making a reservation on the plane and getting myself to the airport and getting on the plane and the flight. I make a plan, and so far I've actually never done that. I can imagine there might be a time. So this feeling can last, especially when I'm traveling, the feeling can last 3 or 4 days. But the underlying circumstances are sort of always, they're always in the background. This feeling that something is wrong, which is very much what the Buddha was speaking of when he used the expression dukkha, that our lives are marked with dukkha. It's a feeling of, sometimes we call it suffering, or it's a feeling of unsatisfactoriness. Even though there's nothing objectively wrong, in those moments I feel like I'm looking behind the curtain of composure, kind of the curtain of my mind, and seeing, you know, it's like this really messy factory behind that actually exists behind that door, so nice and clean in here, and you know, who knows what's back there. So consider a story. It's a bright young man in his late 20s. He's very well educated and physically healthy. Unfortunately, his mother died when he was an infant. And for most of his life, he's stayed at home, quite pampered, with all the advantages of his privileged background, his good clothes, good food, faithful servants. And in time, he becomes married to a beautiful young woman of similar background. And they become the parents of a young son. And these should be the circumstances of a happy life. But they seem something really important seems missing to him. Everybody around him says he should be happy and rejoice, and he just doesn't feel that way. So he makes this decision to leave his home, leave his wife and son, and all of his friends, and he has no particular goal beyond relieving himself of this kind of fatalistic gloom that has settled over him. So for 6 years, he goes around and he explores every trendy diet, every well-advertised teacher, every meditation technology that's available in his day. And ultimately, he just gives up. He says, none of this is going to work. And he goes and finds a tree and sits down under it. And amazingly, things are transformed. So, of course, this is the early life of Shakyamuni Buddha. You could hear it as the description of someone suffering from chronic depression. That's somewhat heretical, but you could hear it that way. Somebody who is acutely attuned to both the external circumstances of his society and his internal unsettledness. So, aside from the fact that I am not a prince, there are some parallels with my life growing up in a very prosperous suburb and being educated. And we are told, and this is also heretical, that the Buddha's suffering fell away when he awakened under the Bodhi tree. He arrived at a place where he was always happy and never anxious. And sometimes I wonder, you know, is this an objectification that that we project because we want to believe that we can be free from conditions, the suffering conditions of our life? Or, as I know Taikin is always, Taikin is a one of the primary translators of Eihei Dogen, and so in Dogen's work there's a line that speaks to this in a very rich way. He says, when Dharma fills your body and mind, you realize that something is missing. Is that included in the perception of the Buddha, that he realized that something was missing and came to terms with it? So, the circumstances of my life are fine. I'm relatively healthy. I have two wonderful children, a good marriage, you know, a stable place to live, yet I often have this experience of displacement, and you know, I wonder if I've been misled, or sometimes if I'm sort of seduced by, you know, what my wife and I have been calling, sometimes people come to Buddhism with the dream of self-fulfillment. So far, that's not happened. Which is not to say I don't feel fulfillment. But I think that we have this idea, understandably, that all those hours and weeks and years of meditation are supposed to lead to happiness and equanimity. And that struggling with depression, with other difficult circumstances of one's life, is a kind of embarrassment or failure. Does it mean to admit that one experiences this? Does that mean that Buddhist practice doesn't always work? Someone in my community said to me, after I gave a talk like this, said, "You're the last person I would think of as depressed." And I didn't want to say, "Well, either you're not so perceptive, or I'm really good at keeping it hidden." But what I will say is that after 30 years of very steady meditation, I have not seen any great cosmic light shows, or had these transcendental visions of reality, which is maybe another way bluntly to say I can't claim any great enlightenment, which, maybe it does mean I'm not so good at this. I should spend more time with Taigen.
You're doing okay.
But that's not to say that I don't feel changed by the practice, or free and joyful at times, because I do. This freedom is momentary. I really appreciate it for what it is, and I don't expect to stay there. It's really a loaded word, stay. A teacher friend of mine admonished me once for writing, said, "Stay in the present." Well, he called me up on the phone, very upset, and said, "You can't stay anywhere." Which is, that's actually right. That's the law of impermanence. That so I do have those experiences. And at the same time, I think that given a propensity towards depression, which may be biochemical, it might be hereditary, it may be karmic, the settledness that I experience in meditation, and I experienced it as soon as we sat down here this morning, that may be as good as it gets for me. And when I think about that quotation from Dogen, "When Dharma fills your body and mind, you realize that something is missing," I tend to I finish it with another short clause, which is, I realize that something is missing, and that's just fine. That completes the thought to me, at least as a message for myself. So this very incompleteness of our being, the incompleteness of our actions and aspirations, is manifestation of Buddha nature itself. I have a CD, some of you heard me do music the other night, the title of that CD is "Everything is Broken." Everything is broken. And I have no regrets about that. Meanwhile, I have tried to deal with depression. That means get rid of. For many years, let's see, I have done talk therapy, acupuncture, organic remedies like St. John's wort and Sam E, and homeopathy, most recently vitamin D. I have been on and off a modest dose of antidepressants, which worked for a time and then seemed not. And nothing has, as shall we say, worked. So the only thing that I can return to, and the thing that I have returned to, which began in faith, I trust meditation. I don't offer it as a panacea. Some teachers I know feel like meditation is the answer to all that might ail you. And I wouldn't say that's necessary. I don't believe it's necessarily the case. I think there's lots of things that one needs to try to find out how to live. But this is one part of it. The two things. Meditation as a way of just knowing how to settle, and friendship. And these two are not unrelated. Meditation is not a cure. But when I sit down in a quiet space and follow my breath, the weight or the cloud that is on me usually lifts. At least it lifts for while I'm sitting. And if I sit for a while, then that energy continues. If sitting isn't possible, I might take a long walk. Either way, what I've done is I've built a bridge across what seems to be an internal disconnect. So I am, in terms of friendship, for that time, friendly with myself. The power of friendship multiplies when extended beyond oneself. I keep in mind the famous epigraph that E.M. Forster wrote to his novel Howard's End. He said, "Only connect. Only connect." So in the dark, in really dark moments, when I actually feel least able to do so, I know that this is necessary and true. So I will leave my room and seek the company and presence of a friend. In the context of depression, friendship is what the alchemists would call an alkahest, which is the universal solvent that brings forth light and energy. So there's a gift also to this condition of depression, which is the ability to identify with people who are in pain, because one knows the pain oneself. One knows the nature of suffering, and one can recognize it in others and identify with it, understand it. So many people that I've spoken to in private interviews, in Dokusan, we call practice discussion, have told me about the pain that they live with. pain of isolation and loneliness, depression, also physical illness. And I really find myself moved by their predicament and by their honesty, by their willingness to share that with me. They suffer in ways as I have suffered, and I feel myself to be like them. So all these years later, after years and years, and I won't go into kind of the backstory of how I found a name for what I was experiencing, but all these years, I continued to live with this condition. And this is, and its companion, which is anxiety. And this is one of the Buddha's unique discoveries. He described the wheel of life, or what we call dependent origination. And the fuel that turns this wheel is, you could call it, anxiety. The wheel is made to roll through birth and death, and on through successive lives. And anxiety is its fuel. But let me suggest that rather than thinking of this wheel of birth and life, birth and death, as spinning through this life and then the next life and then the next life, think about it as our rebirth moment by moment. In one moment, one experiences some anxiety for reasons that may not be immediately accessible to you. And then you're born in Buddhist terms, there were six sort of existential realms: human realm, God realm, animal realm, hungry ghost, fighting demon, and what am I leaving out? Hell realm. But these are really just shorthand for infinite states of mind. And when something happens, you know, when someone scares you by cutting you off on the road, you are born in a realm. You know, you become a fighting demon, or you become, or you go to hell. And this is what we are practicing with. So we're practicing with rebirth moment by moment. And this depression is a condition of a particular patterned life that I have. But what I feel about Buddhist practice is it's simply a method to become awake, which means to know where you are in any given moment, to know who you are in any given moment. So if I'm a fighting demon, I can reflect on that and say, okay, if I live out this model of existence, I'm going to really cause a lot of pain and make a lot of trouble for everybody and myself. So how do I take care of that? How do I be a friend to myself without letting that self run amok? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true with any form of suffering. For the Buddha, if you read his biography, what you come across stories of injury, illness, temptation, betrayal, loss. You know, it wasn't all fun and games to be the Buddha. As Suzuki Roshi said, Suzuki Roshi was once reported to have said about enlightenment, he said, "You may not like it." Because it means really knowing who you are moment for moment. And each one of those difficulties was an opportunity for the Buddha to learn and then to share his understanding. He didn't immediately go to change the external conditions or to avoid them. And he wasn't pushed around by his internal or external circumstances. He lived in community, though, and he lived with his friends, and he turned towards the suffering that he experienced. So I feel like there's a message, at least for me, in the work that I have to do with myself around depression. That message is that things in life are always moving. If I can see through it, if I can bear it, then depression becomes a harbinger of transformation. If I can only connect, if I can turn towards a friend, if I can be a friend, and with that kind of understanding, life becomes a kind of fortunate accident. Even if I'm feeling some despair, I am alive. I am alive, so change is possible. And if I ask myself, one of the questions that brought me to practice is God went to a therapist and said, "Well, what am I doing here on the planet?" I actually did this, and she said, "That's not a therapy question."
Good for her.
That's a spiritual question. So, what am I doing here on the planet? And in that moment, if I can reflect, I realize, I'm just kind of being at home, trying to be at home in what the Buddhist texts call the Saha world, which translates as the world, the realm in which one must practice endurance. It's the world that one has to bear. There are other realms, if you read the Buddhist text, there are realms where people are fed by music and wonderful food is dropping off the trees and everything is nice. But in our realm, where it's possible to become a Buddha, it's the realm where we have to know how to endure. It's the realm where we live in samsara, which literally means wandering on. And samsara is, in our Mahayana view, just another frame for nirvana, for liberation. So the heart of Buddhist practice is our friendship, and it's our faith. And it's a faith in a dark night when faith seems hard to find. And my friends helped me get through the night. But whether it's night and day, depression and joy, there's really one whole true life. All I can do is practice with and in the midst of that one true life. And that's where I would like to live with all of you. So I think that's where I'm going to end and leave time for some discussion and comments. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hozan. I'd like to start with actually three, I'll try and keep them very brief, comments myself. And thank you for your friendship. You mentioned something about not having experienced, I forget what you called them, great cosmic light shows or something. And having at times in Zazen experienced that myself doesn't solve anything. So forget about that. Okay.
Let me just say something. I think what I was, what I've been pondering is not whether there's something deficient in me, but just whether even my interpretation of that is skewed by either almost biochemically skewed. You know, so I can't even say that I haven't had that, because there are lots of things that do happen in Zazen, but they're not on these kind of earth-shaking, cataclysmic scale. And I just figured, okay, that may be the way it is for me.
Yeah, and we're each different, you know, in so many ways, biochemically and otherwise. But even the Buddha, and you mentioned the Buddha talking about something is missing, and Dogen says as well that Buddhas are Buddhas going beyond Buddha. And so the Buddha, after his awakening, continued to practice every day, and I would say continue to reawaken every day. And so there's no awakening is ongoing. It's not, you don't get to some place and then everything's fixed. And that's another way of talking about what you're talking about. Anxiety continues, dukkha continues. We still have to continue finding how to be here. And then the last thing I was going to say, speaking of everything is broken, is everybody I've ever really talked to is damaged. Mm-hmm. Myself, of course, included.
Yeah.
So how do we face that, you know? And, you know, how do we each in our own way be wounded healers, to use that phrase? So, yeah, we're all damaged. Everything is broken. All of us and everything is broken in some way, and yet we do this practice where we can sit and in some way connect to, think of it as connecting to wholeness.
Yeah.
You talked about it in other ways. Anyway, I just wanted to say that, but also now to open this up to, it was a wonderful, I think, provocative talk, so I'm sure there are other comments and responses. Maybe you have something else to say to them.
One quick thing, which is just that that each of us is damaged, and we have to find the first thing the Buddha taught was, he said, I'm teaching the middle way. Mm. And so we have to find the middle way, which includes honesty about who we are. And it does not, we should be careful not to wallow in our damagedness. So what's the middle way there? Other comments or questions?
Carla.
So you said that it's that something is missing and that's okay. But I wonder if somehow we bear a responsibility to make things whole. So for something to be missing, maybe that's not okay. Because maybe we are called to do something to make whatever is missing whole.
I think that's right. Taigen was whispering in Hebrew this tikkun olam. Tikkun olam. What I would say, the other thing to remember about anything that you read or hear in the Dharma is that it's medicine. Dogen was saying, Dogen put out this thought as a balance, and actually there's a balancing. I'm trying to remember exactly the phrase that precedes that.
When Dharma fills your body and mind,
Dharma does not fill your body and mind, you think it is already sufficient.
Yeah.
So what he was pointing to, so every teaching is a medicine to bring us back into balance. So you have just offered medicine to bring, you've offered some balance to what I was saying. I think we do. And that's the vast side of the Bodhisattva, incomprehensible vastness of the Bodhisattva vow is, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. There's a major contradiction built into that expression. And the same thing is true, delusions are numberless, I vow to put an end to them. So, yes, to each of these things has its balance. But I think what he was offering was a recognition that it's not the fact of its incompleteness that's the source of our suffering. It's the fact that we want... This is what my wife has hammered into me. If I'm having a hard time or I'm complaining about somebody, she says, well, the problem is you want things to be different from how they are. And that's true in that moment. And then if I can settle myself on myself in how things are at that moment, then I'm allowing for creativity to arise that might be helpful or creative, helpful in changing the circumstances. So it's sort of a long response to your to the point question. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. I appreciate it when long-time practitioners admit that they're still practicing and there's difficulty. But, I find it inspirational. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. It should be daunting because you've been practicing for so long. But I find it inspirational. Question, I was hoping you could respond to this. Some people, myself included, have come to practice to deal with this depression or dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of what you were saying, where zazen or meditation is not the panacea for that. And I have difficulty saying that to people that come to practice for that. Do you kind of know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Have you found a way to describe zazen beneficially?
Yes. I'm wary of all panaceas, but I'm quite willing to talk about my life and what I've seen. So I'm opening a door on something here that's difficult and challenging in an ongoing way. But the other side of it is my life is wonderful, and all the gifts of my the real gifts of my life have sort of come out of, in a sense you could say, come out of Zazen, including, you know, feeling like I have meaningful work to do in the world and good relations with people, not, I may have depression, but I'm never bored, and I know that there are things to do in the world. And, you know, I will say that the worst part of the anxiety leading up to practice, actually, was that real question, what the fuck am I doing here? You know, it's like I have intelligence. I feel like I have some capacity. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing that's going to be useful to me or anybody else. And I feel like when I looked around, when I came to Berkeley Zen Center, I came to San Francisco Zen Center, and I looked around, I don't think it was entirely projection, but I saw people who seemed comfortable in their skins and doing work, being in the world in ways that I really appreciated and respected. And I felt like, okay, these are, you know, these are good models. And then each of us has to find our own particular manifestation of that. But we have, but it's also within a framework of practice. So, and I really encourage people when they come, because I had a certain faith, and it did take years. You know, it took some years of actually just sitting down cross-legged, which wasn't fun, and it wasn't easy. For some people, it is easy. It was hard, but I believed in this process because I had nothing else to do. And it unfolded and continues to unfold. Thank you.
I really want to thank you for this talk. This is one of the clearest inspiring, I agree to, presentations I've ever heard. I loved your description of the Buddha's early life and what led him. And on a practical basis, I'm wondering if I could get a copy of
it. Yes, I can. If you give me your email, I can. Actually, oh no, I think it's on my website. www.clearviewproject.org. Yeah.
John.
I very much appreciated your comments as a long time sufferer of depression. And it's not something that people are willing to talk about, so I appreciate that. At times I felt like, yeah, you were describing my own life, even mentioning Howard Zinn, which I was forced to read in high school. I'm too much of a beginner at this to I think appreciate the Buddhist context, but I didn't come here to try and eradicate my depression, which I don't think is comfortably is not really possible. It's something to manage. And I'm not sure why I come here, but I'm happy for people to offer me reasons. But again, I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we actually have an idea that we have come to eradicate something. And, I do think that what I learn over time, what I'm trying to learn is what is being offered to me by each moment. You know, even these moments that I would really like to get out of. You know, it's like if I can stop for a moment and just say, okay, is there something that's being given to me that I can learn from? That, I think, is the turning question in each moment. And I think I wasn't here, and I haven't read Norman Fisher's book yet, but he lectured here a couple weeks ago, right? And he lecture on the mind training verses?
Yes.
I mean, I think that's the whole thrust of the mind training verses is like, okay, every mind state is an offering, and these verses are very practical tools for kind of, you know, cracking open the shell so you can see what's being offered. And we have we have various approaches for doing that. Some people, they want to work with slogans. Some people find out how to do this in other ways. There's all of Buddhism is just one medicine, one tool after another.
Yes, Deborah.
I was very moved by your talk. Thank you. And really appreciate your honesty.
Thank you.
Any other questions or responses? Douglas.
I appreciated you talking about using the word wallowing. That evokes a lot for me. And I was wondering, is depression, sitting with depression, is it different from sitting with other moods or emotions like anger or anxiety? You know, sometimes you can be wallowing in an emotion or a mood, and I don't know, I think of it with a spatial metaphor somehow. You're sort of wrapped up in it, and to the extent that you're even aware of what's going on around you, it's completely caught up. You're seeing it from that anxiety or
right.
Anger. When I sit down and come back to the breathing and the posture, it's almost like there's an opening up. And I'm certainly, anger or anxiety doesn't go away, but there's a space, and instead of maybe being inside the anxiety or the anger, you're sort of with the anxiety or the anger, you're engaged with it somehow differently.
Right.
Is depression like that?
I think it can be. You know, it depends on how one works. It's particularly, all of these really strong afflictive emotions, I think, are particularly seductive in that when they are happening, they're also, you know, there are neurotransmitters that are zooming around our body. I don't profess to know a lot about the activity of the brain, but I feel like I've experienced that. So when you're in the middle of this, it's not just a state of mind that you can easily set aside. It's actually a physiological condition. And so you really need to apply your mind and your body to that physiological condition if you want it to change. So my suggestion is that your attitude towards this is... as in the Metta Sutta, just as a mother watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should one suffuse love over the entire world. Which means, basically, you have to... This is another expression of Dogen's, it's a parental mind. You know, so the parental mind towards one's afflictive emotion is like... simultaneously a kind of unconditional love, because this is me, this is a creature of my mind and being, and an ability to set boundaries and limits without that being in contradiction to the love. Does that make sense? So how do you do that? I mean, each of us has to work out a way of doing it, but just we get in trouble with our children when we have no boundaries and we think, you know, they are us and we are them. But as soon as you can have this slight amount of light or distance, as you were saying, then you can function as an adult, as a grown-up towards towards the willfulness of this afflictive emotion. And I think that the method of sitting down and watching, shikantaza, of being receptive to whatever thought or feeling is arising, not believing in it fully, but recognizing it, letting it have its own lifespan. So that, to me, is a manifestation of, it's one manifestation of parental love.
Thank you.